This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark Coman is here. Good afternoon to you, though he's grumpy because he hasn't got his coffee.
So, no, it's coming, and as soon as it comes, I'll suddenly, you know, up my game to that usual hyper-caffeinated level.
And when do you up your game? How will we know?
Well, suddenly, you know, it'll all start being zingy and brilliant. Or if it doesn't, that's just because you're listening on the podcast and we've cut those bits out.
That's true. Hugh Dancy is also with us. His new movie is Shooting Dogs, in which he co-stars with John Hurt. Hugh, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you.
The 1994 genocide in Rwanda is a tough ask for a movie audience. They'll have seen it before, of course, in Hotel Rwanda. Tell us the story and the side of this appalling story which your movie tackles.
Well, I mean, first of all, as you say, you can only tell one little part of this story. It's so immense. And the story we tell is of a true event that took place within the widespread atrocities of 1994 in a school compound inside Kigali, which, as well as being a school, also housed about 70, I think, Belgian UN soldiers, which led to 2,500 Tutsis seeking refuge there when the killing started. And to cut a long story short, subsequently being abandoned by those UN soldiers when they left the country with the rest of the UN and being slaughtered. So in that sense, I suppose you could say it's a microcosm of the bigger picture and focuses upon our culpability in being so remiss towards that country.
Who's our?
By us, it depends. You could say the UN, you can say the West, you could say the white world. It kind of depends what angle you want to take. But that's what. But I just mean us, really. Yes, I think the outside world.
So you're using the story of the character Father Christopher, played by John Hurt, inspired by a real man.
That's right. The John's character is inspired by a priest who David Belton, the producer, met when he was working as a journalist in Rwanda in 94, a man who, I believe, subsequently lost his life and was an Eastern European Catholic priest, I think, and sheltered David at one stage. But they are, his character and my character are amalgams, if you like, of both of different people and of different characteristics that allow... that I suppose allow them to become a kind of conduit for a Western audience as they watch, as our characters and as the audience watch these events unfold.
It is explaining the unexplainable, isn't it? I was trying to answer some questions from my 14-year-old yesterday and failing miserably as to, first of all, the facts, which I was able to look up, and then we can pass that on. But in trying to explain how ordinary people could do what they did to other ordinary people, because the genocide that we were told about at school, the Nazi Holocaust, it happened in camps. It happened away from other people. The genocide in Rwanda and in your film happens in schools and in shops and in high streets and in people's gardens. Mm. And it's carried out by your next door neighbour.
I think you've put your finger on the thing that makes it so hard to understand. And what I came up against in Rwanda as well is that you can kind of take on board the statistics, although they're staggering, and it's really pretty hard to make sense of them. But ultimately you hit a kind of wall when you're faced with these questions of why and how could this, you know, how could people bring themselves to a state where everybody is killing everybody else? And I found that is those questions, in a way, are the ones that people in Rwanda are still struggling to come to terms with themselves. Quite apart from just the details of their own losses, and you're right, it's kind of almost unanswerable, I think.
Were you slightly nervous about going back to the country so soon after? Because it's just, you know, it is barely a decade ago. The people with whom you were acting, the people with whom presumably you were filming, this is their country. This is the school where actually there was a massacre, as I understand it. It all seemed extremely raw still.
We were filming in the school where these events took place, and although most of the people there lost their lives, there were some survivors, and some of them were working with us. And of course, everybody in Rwanda is a survivor in one form or another. And if they haven't suffered themselves, you know, awful trauma, they've certainly witnessed it. It's just that widespread. And I was nervous about that because it's, you know, sitting here You really don't know what to expect at all. I was nervous about how we would be received, and I was nervous about what my own response would be. And as it turned out, because of the reception was so generous and so warm and so much desire on their behalf to be involved in telling the story, that the experience for me was an incredibly uplifting one, both in terms of the individual friendships I made and in terms of the, you know, this rare privilege, basically, of telling the story.
There were reports in the papers a couple of weeks ago that some people who were involved in the filming in the area were quite traumatised by the fact that the cameras were back and you were reenacting this scene with the noise and the whistling of the machete-wielding tribe that are at the gates, that actually all that brought a lot of it back, and there were some, well, there were quite a few negative stories around.
It's interesting. I mean, there's what this stems from actually is one incident that did take place. I mean, a terrible and regrettable incident when the safeguards that had been put in place, both by us, the film crew, and also by the Rwandan government, who were very involved in it, I suppose, were proved inadequate, and a few people in a school nearby to where we were filming overheard this sound and were traumatised, I suppose you'd say. Unfortunately, I think that's grown to a point where people start to say, well, surely you're just traumatising people by getting them involved. And the truth of the matter is that in this country, people are living with trauma every single day of their lives. And I was back in Kigali this weekend watching the movie with a Rwandan audience of thousands, many of whom have been involved, and many of whom were deeply upset and were crying and so on around me. But there's a great difference between being upset and being traumatised. And I think, and I now believe and know that the experience that they had on this movie has helped a lot of people towards, I hope, coming to some kind of understanding of their past.
And I think, Mark, one of the reactions, I mean, people would have felt the same during Hotel Rwanda, but also watching this movie, that sense of guilt that we have because we sat through it, we kind of knew what was going on, we didn't pay it that much attention, as is typified by, you know, as Bill Clinton has said, it was a huge regret of his, you know, and you're just thinking, hang on, this is in my lifetime, and I knew what about this?
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, I have to say that I thought in advance, you know, that the film was going to some extent to be a footnote to Hotel Rwanda, and of course it is much more than that. I think it's very powerful. It is astonishing that it happened with so little recognition, and I have to say, as somebody who spends his life in the movies, almost everything I know about it, I know from the movies, and I think the movies have a perfect right to address those subjects. I also think that it's worth saying that the film is about other things as well as this. I mean, firstly, you know that it's going to end in this terrible massacre, but actually that is all dealt with very well. The sense of dread, the sense of what is coming is appalling, but actually it's dealt with great restraint at the actual moment itself. The other thing is that in the middle of it all, there is this story of this priest, and amidst the appalling story of, you know, the UN effectively abandoning these people, there is a story of sacrifice, and there is a spiritual dimension to it. In when he's asked why he's staying, he says, you know, somebody said to me, where is God? And I think God is here in the middle of all this horror and suffering. Now, I thought it was a very powerful film. I thought it dealt with those subjects, those historical subjects, accurately as far as I know. But I think a film always needs more than that. Hotel Rwanda had more than that. And I think this does too, in that it has another dimension to it that makes it, you know, also a universal story, as well as simply a historical thing, which says this is awful. This happened in the recent past. I mean, the scenes toward the end, when you know what's coming, and when the French are withdrawing, I mean, it is an absolutely horrible sense of I cannot believe that this happened, and it's a great credit to the movie that is the sense that you have. I mean, I know that when you saw it, you said what you know you don't want to get to the end because you know what's coming.
Well, I have already confessed to Hugh that I didn't get to the end. I watched the first half and I knew exactly what was coming and just not sure whether I could bring myself. I mean, I might go back and do it again. But, you know, there is that sense of foreboding, exactly as Mark says, that sense of foreboding because you know exactly what's going to happen. You see these delightful people who are in the school and you think, I'm not sure if I can sit now and.
But there is an extraordinary dignity from them and also from the Father Christopher character during the worst of it all that I think does take the film to a different level. I think there is a spiritual dimension to it, which it needs, because otherwise you would simply look at it and think this is just unbearable on every single level. And it's important that a film doesn't lose an audience by hurting them too much, you know.
I think that's right, and I think that comes back to what you were saying before about these huge questions of why this could happen, how this could happen. Those questions are so big that whether you tell it through a character like Father Christopher, who's dealing it on a religious level or not, it has that magnitude, you know, of a kind of semi-religious scale. And, I mean, that's one of the first things that attracted me to it, actually, that it threw that question of faith into the mix. Which is not necessarily a hot or fashionable topic.
There is a marvellous moment in it when this thing is going to happen and Father Christopher gets asked, you know, there is nothing we can do. There is nothing we can do, is there? And he says, yes, what we can do is we can administer communion. And whether or not that's meant to be ironic or whether it's meant to be straight is left very deliberately ambiguous by the film. And your response to that question, you know, is deliberately ambiguous.
You're us, really. I wonder if your kind of bafflement of what's going on and the fact that you at the beginning of the film, you clearly don't know anything about the racial division between these people. You're our sort of eyes through the film. We get it all explained through you, really.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think realistically, it's a bit of a stretch to imagine that anybody could be in Rwanda, however,
and be quite as baffled as you.
Be as totally ignorant. Yeah.
But then he says, "I feel like I'm starring in my very own Oxfam commercial," isn't it? Which is exactly his position.
That's right. And I mean, you know, he's two things. I mean, one, he's a very hopefully a real person in this situation, but secondly, he does act as a kind of greater, as I said, as a kind of conduit for just a Western audience in general. And my aim with this character, as well as making him real, was to present that very, very fine division between innocence and naivety, and ultimately a kind of denial.
But may I also say that one of the criticisms that have been levelled against the film is that, well, you know, it's a film seen through the eyes of white characters in order to mediate it for a white audience. Well, can I just say, actually, there is a huge audience out there that needs to be told this story, and whatever it takes to get them dramatically engaged is perfectly fine. I think that people have become incredibly idealistically purist about this, whether it be the news stories about what happened. You know, it is funny how incredibly difficult people are being about it. I think it does what
and also
it
on that,
needs
it
to be done.
Oscar Schindler had his story to tell,
and it
doesn't matter where he came from. It's an interesting story because of what he did.
It's an outsider looking in.
Well, I think that's the point, is that this is not... I mean, it's a great device, and if it brings audiences to the movie, I'm more than happy. But I think it's more than a device. It's the point of the story. You know, this is a scene through white eyes because we're talking about the abandonment of the country by the rest of the world.
Exactly.
And not to make a point... not to make that point and not to involve the question of the rest of the world in how and why this happened would be completely to abandon.
And also, if the film is seen through the eyes of your character and your character does eventually abandon them in the same way, you know, if you do, as you said at the beginning, this whole sense of guilt of our own involvement, I think that was the sort of the central question. And you do feel that. You do feel that because you do have something invested in those characters.
Yes, of course. I mean, were it somehow to become my tragedy or even worse, a great act of bravery on the part of my character, that would be terrible. But it's certainly not that story.
And I wonder also, I think people will watch that and wonder how much of the history since 1994 comes from that, because you watch that and think, why didn't we get involved? Then the next time ethnic cleansing turned up, the world did get involved, and then there is this whole history, which I don't need to go into now, of people getting involved, and I wonder how much of it started in Rwanda and Western guilt that it didn't do anything.
Well, you say that, but I mean, ironically, when we were in Rwanda filming, I would come back at the end of the day, go to the hotel, turn on my TV and watch the news unfolding in Sudan. And meanwhile, back in New York, the UN were talking about whether to have talks about whether to get involved. And frankly, exactly the same thing was happening without, you know, and I suspect, sadly, that maybe a little sooner, but still another 5 or 6 years down the line, we'll be making a movie about Darfur.
Can you clear one thing up? This email from David Pilling says that the point is that in real history, the priest didn't stay. All the Caucasian residents, including the priest, evacuated with the UN troops. It was the black Africans that were left and died. Now, I know this priest was murdered in Kigali, but was that a few years later?
No. As I say, this character, the character of Father Christopher, is no one individual.
Sort of, yeah.
He represents a lot of different things. And for me, the The point, I think, about Father Christopher staying is that it throws into relief my character's decision to leave. And it really raises the bigger questions that you were describing earlier of faith in the face of this almost, you know, incomprehensible disaster. And that would be how, that's how I see it.
Well, also, he gets to voice them because his character says, "If I feel that if I go, I will lose everything because everything I believe in is here." And what the other side of that is saying is, you're all going and you are all losing everything. And I think it is perfectly legitimate dramatic license to have that character do that because it makes sense. And I do want to stress to people listening to this, you shouldn't just think, oh, Shooting Dogs is just a film which starts at a point of total and utter despair and then goes worse from there, because that would simply put people off. It is dramatically engaging. And one of the reasons it is for exactly these reasons. I think they are legitimate inventions.
Okay, we'll do some more on this in just a second. Mark Kermode is here and Hugh Dancy is here as well, and he stars alongside John Hurt in Shooting Dogs, and he's also starring, although not mentioned on the poster, disappointingly, in Basic Instinct 2. And is it just coincidence then, Mark and Hugh, that this director chappy has
Michael Caton-Jones has done
both films, and they're out today, both of them?
It is an extraordinary coincidence. I mean, of course, Shooting Dogs was 2005, Basic Instinct 2 is 2006, and it just happens to be the coincidence of when they both came out, because Shooting Dogs has taken longer to get released.
Can you think of more contrasting movies?
I absolutely can't. And since we're here at this moment, because I think we should now do this, can we do the Basic Instinct?
Yes.
Just to set this up, okay, so here's sorry. So it's the long-belated sequel to Basic Instinct. For ages and ages, there was a couple of scripts knocking around. There was an Esther House script. It was going to happen. It wasn't going to happen. Then Cronenberg was going to direct it. Then this, that, and the other happened. Now, obviously, I have to state from the outset that I have a great interest in this movie because, as you know, I keep saying every week, you know, Linda, my other half, wrote the erotic thriller in contemporary cinema, which is the great history of the erotic thriller in contemporary cinema. So I have seen more trash straight-to-video erotic thrillers than is good for any man, and I have only, you know, scraped the top of the iceberg of the stuff that she is interested in. And everyone expected Basic Instinct 2 to be absolutely clunkingly dreadful and then some, okay?
At this point, everyone still thinks, fancy being married to someone who makes you watch soft pornography.
It's not, but it's so much...
Sorry, erotic
anyway,
thrillers.
Anyway, so, I know that this is difficult because if you've seen the reviews of the movie they're at today, they are absolutely...
Where does Hugh come into it?
Hugh's in the... Well, can we explain... You do it, because otherwise I don't want to give away any plot details.
Let's not talk about him as though he's not here.
Well, no, but go on.
You're just trying to get out of it.
No, I'm not. I'm going
to... Well, I don't know what to explain, except that I meet a sticky end somewhere along the line. Do you want me to give the whole complicated...
No, I don't.
Wheels within wheels.
Right. Do we like you in the film?
No.
I hope we feel a little sorry when I'm found basically naked.
You can't give this away. You can't give that away.
Okay. Okay, well, I don't know what to say then, except I'm pretty creepy.
Okay, that's
yeah.
So look, here's the thing, okay? I've been dying to this, okay? The reviews are unspeakably bad, with the exception of three people in the world, okay? Nigel Floyd in Time Out, he wrote a review that said, and he's absolutely right, it's better than we had any right to expect. Linda Ruth Williams, author of The Erotic Thriller in Contemporary Cinema, who said, unbelievably, it's like...
That's your wife.
It's like a bunch of... She saw it a long time before me. She said, it's like a bunch of people sat down, watched Basic Instinct, read all the academic articles about Basic Instinct, and then said, you know, what fun can we have with this? And, I'm sorry, I'm putting my... Me. I enjoyed the heck out of Basic Instinct 2. It is aware of itself in a way that very few people understand. I was in a screening when literally the entire audience was laughing at it. And the funny thing was, the film was laughing straight back at them. Michael Caton-Jones is a director who understands what needs to be done for each job. Henry Bean and Leora Barish are smart, intelligent scriptwriters who are having... I mean, the dialogue is just insane. It is things like, at one point, it says Catherine Terrell left her own party. Oh, how Lacanian of her. I mean, it is just laugh out loud
so
funny.
So it's rubbish?
No, it is rubbish, but it's
enjoyable.
Really... It is top quality trash of the highest order. It is well directed. It has a terrific central performance by David Morris, who gets the gag. It has David Thewlis chewing the scenery up and spitting it out for all he is worth. It shoots London like it's San Francisco, with a phallic gherkin building in every other shot and light glancing off these shiny exteriors. It is a movie made for people who understand generic conventions. And I am sorry, the British press...
Who understand generic...
It's an erotic thriller. It's not a movie which is... They wouldn't say that. Who's he? Where's he? That wouldn't happen. It's a movie in which in the first 3 minutes, a famous footballer goes off
Stan
into
Collymore.
Stan Collymore goes in a Porsche driving at 100 miles an hour whilst in flagrante delicto with Sharon Stone. It's not based on
real life. If you don't get it
life.
At that stage, you're really not going to get it, are you?
Exactly. And I suppose
it does help in terms of understanding erotic thrillers if you're married to a woman who's written a book about them.
Yeah, but if you have any... I'm sorry, as somebody who grew up on the horror genre, look, here's the thing. If you say to somebody it's a comedy, the comedy contract is this. You make me laugh and I'll let you do what you want, okay? The horror contract is this. You scare me and I'll let you do what you want. The erotic thriller contract is this. You thrill me and give me something a little bit sexy because, hey, as we all know, we like to watch and you can do whatever you want. And what I really enjoyed was the sense of those writers, because it is a good screenplay. I don't care what anyone says. The sense of those writers just saying, we are really going to have some fun with this. And everyone that's in the film understands the level on which it's working, with the possible exception of Stan Collymore. But I think even he knows where it is. I mean, I sat there with a grin on my face from ear to ear. It is top quality trash.
What do you think, Hugh?
I think that's actually a brilliant analysis.
You're in the studio with the only reviewer who's going to talk
three
about
of us,
it like that.
Three of us.
Yeah, but you're married to one of them.
That's yeah, but plural.
Yeah, but she was there first. She was there first.
I think that the analysis of Michael Caton Jones, the director, is spot on. And I read a quote that he, in the newspaper the other day, he said, the coincidence of these two movies coming out on the same day is just God's way of illustrating my genius. Classic modesty there from Michael. But he is exactly that. He can go from story to story and apply the right tools for the job, you know. And, you know, he's not somebody who's set up his stall and tell the same kind of story again and again. But he's an incredibly versatile artist, in my book.
I love the there was a review in one of the papers which suggests, because David Morrissey, of course, famously played Gordon Brown
on television.
And he said David is a great actor, but because he was afraid that it wouldn't be possible to watch this film and forget that actually this is Gordon Brown whispering about endogenous growth theory into Sharon Stone.
Yeah, but you know what that is? I'm sorry, that's lazy journalism.
It's a good joke.
It's a cheap shot, and it's late because 90% of British, you know, UK film critics do not understand genre. And I am frankly sick of working in an area in which people don't understand genre.
Resign?
Look down on horror movies. Oh, no, am I going to resign? No, I'm just going to outlive all of the rest of them. I'm sorry. The fact of the matter is, I'm right, they're wrong, that's it.
Okay, well, we've established that. Now, we need to do the box office top 10. We should do the box office top 10 while you're still with us, Hugh, even though we're late for the news. So if you've seen any of these, want to contribute to the top 10, just chip in. All right, better make this briefer than normal,
okay.
Dr. Kermode. 10 is Chicken Little.
It's all right. I mean, but it's not all right, actually. No, it's an animated kids' film which turns into War of the Worlds.
I love it already. I haven't seen it.
Oh, right.
I watched it immediately.
Believe me, that makes it sound better than it is.
Date movie at 9.
It's rubbish, 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 rubbish. And that is a genre movie which doesn't satisfy. The contract is, you make me laugh, and then it's like, in your own time.
8 is Walk the Line.
Which is fantastic. Great
movie.
It is great, though, isn't it?
Yeah, fantastic.
Are you in that as well?
No, I couldn't wangle it.
Syriana at 7.
Incomprehensible, and I think it's Stephen Gagan showing off. I know that all the posh people think that it's very clever to make a movie that's vaguely incomprehensible. I think it's bad structure, but there we go.
I think a lot of the movie got cut out. That's the impression I got.
I would certainly hope so.
The Hills Have Eyes at 6.
It's not as good as the original, but Alexandra Aya has got a very good eye for the edgy.
I think a lot of stuff gets cut out of that as well, but
that's all on screen.
5 is The Ringer.
You know what? The funny thing about The Ringer is it's actually very, very well intentioned, and people are just about getting the idea that the Farrelly brothers' bad taste is in fact in extremely good taste. And it's very sweet-natured, and despite all the negative publicity about it in advance, I think its heart is in the right place.
I'm just worried that we're heading towards Pink Panther.
It's all right.
Okay. Yes, we are. At 4, V for Vendetta.
It's, you know, I really liked it. Again, all the British press. 1 star. Terrible. Destroying Alan Moore's work. How dare they? Actually, quite an interesting movie. Very seditious ending. I got a marvellous email from a friend the other day who said, you know, really, really enjoyed it. And I said, that's fine. That's why you're my friend and everybody else isn't.
And actually, did you know it's Hugh behind the mask? It's not Hugo Weaving.
Yes.
It's actually Hugh Dancy. But, you know, frankly, who knows?
I thought it was Stan Collymore, but.
Okay, number 3, The Pink Panther.
Rubbish.
I mean, what can you say?
You can say rubbish.
Rubbish.
It is just rubbish. You know, there's a Pink Panther movie already that doesn't have Peter Sellers in. We did this last week and I forgot his name again.
The Italian.
No, not that. Not the son of Pink Panther. Roberto,
you know, I
Bellini.
Said briefer than normal.
Sorry. It's okay. Worse than that. You know, shutting your hand in the car door? That's funny in comparison with the Pink Panther.
The Easter release hit too, Hostel.
Which, you know, it's puerile and it's childish, but it's a date movie. It's a take a date, be sick in your popcorn, they'll cuddle you, it'll be nice.
It's horrific.
No, it's not horrific. I mean, it's nasty, but in a completely amiable and harmless way. I mean, it's just, you know, it's
yes,
just
of course.
Sadism and like, sex are idiots.
Like
you know,
any date, yeah. Sadism and sex.
And the UK's number one is Inside Man.
Which I think is a smart and intelligent thriller. It's clearly not one of Spike Lee's deepest works, but he wanted to make something that was, you know, had a good visual sheen to it, which it absolutely does, has good character actors in it, which it absolutely does, and hopefully it'll bankroll more serious work like the Hurricane Katrina documentary, which is coming up, and I thought it was perfectly fine.
Seen it, Hugh?
I haven't yet, but I will be.
Right, you can go then. What do we see you in next?
There's a Blood and Chocolate movie I made at the end of last year, which covers about every genre. So we'll see.
Is that named after the Elvis Costello song?
Probably. I'm sure it'll be in there somewhere.
You mean you're in it and you don't know?
I'm afraid to say okay. That's true, yeah.
Hugh, nice to meet you. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. This from John in Airdrie, having been an avid listener of your outstanding podcast. I had to listen back to some of the back catalogue and heard a review of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, was unsure about this movie as it does have two actors starring in it I universally loathe.
Yeah.
But when I saw it in the video shop, I thought, what the hell, very glad I did. It is an outstanding movie, very funny and lighthearted, complete escapism, and even the second worst Batman was solid. Keep up the rant, they're the highlight of the show. Do we have a rant scheduled before four?
I thought I just did it, didn't I?
Well, no, we were expecting a rant about Basic Instinct 2, but we didn't get one.
I'm confounding all expectations. But you know what you do? People say, oh, he's only saying that to be contrary. No, I'm saying it because I'm right.
If you want to access the podcast, you can do that via the Five Live website, or you can go to iTunes. You're looking for Mark Kermode's movie reviews, and there's also a podcast of this program, which is called The Daily Mayo. You can click on both, and it won't cost you anything. This from Colin: Kermode's quiff is definitely getting bigger. Interesting that Lamar's quiff has disappeared. Is there a link?
No, he just bailed out earlier than me. I think he got fed up with it, but I'm never going to get fed up with it.
Michael on this says, dear Simon and Mark, now that Dr. Williams, this is your wife, yes?
Well, please don't refer to her as that because I'll get, you know, thumped.
How should I refer to her?
My superior.
Now that Dr. Williams, Mark's wife, has given Basic Instinct to the thumbs up, so to speak, on Radio 4, will the meeker, milder doctor in the family dare to disagree? Michael, clearly you think you have your answer. He had his script written by Dr. Williams earlier, and he came in and he did it. Martin saw Viva Vendetta last night. Mark is right. Found it stylish.
You see, I'm sorry. Have faith.
Stylish, more thought-provoking than most mainstream films, and on a couple of occasions, even moving. And Miles, on this email, which I don't believe, but anyway, he says, I was working at Pinewood whilst filming on Basic Instinct 2 took place. I turned up to work one day and found a trailer with a sign saying Thai prostitute on the door. I was very disappointed as I thought it was an overtime incentive and not a generic convention. How silly of me, says Miles. And Frank, on this, you've whetted my appetite, having listened to you talk about shooting dogs with Mark's always excellent crit of the film. I want to see it, but I live in Birmingham, and of 8 cinemas checked on the net, none are showing it, at least for this week. Why not? Can you explain how a city this size manages to pass it over?
Well, my assumption is that what they'll do is that they'll do a staggered release, that it'll open in London and then key cities in the second week. That just is, it's one of the... It tends to be that with movies that they think will have a critical head of steam, that's what they do. They open them in one city, maybe even in one cinema, and it's always in London. I mean, I wait for the day that somebody opens a movie in Southampton, but it hasn't happened yet. Why does it have to be London?
You?
Well, but what I'm saying is, why does it have to open in London? I mean, everyone keeps saying...
Because it's the capital?
Well, yeah, but you said that like it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, where else would you open a movie?
Well, I wouldn't live here.
I don't think that's the question. You've subtly changed it. Anyway, we've done you Shooting Dogs and Basic Instinct 2. What else is out?
Firewall, which I have to say had a great pedigree, and I went in. It's always the case now that you go in with your expectations, and whatever you expect, the opposite turns out to be true. So, you know, edgy thriller with a sort of up-to-the-minute plot, stars Paul Bettany, well, co-stars Paul Bettany, Harrison Ford and Paul Bettany. Paul Bettany is a computer bank robber whose accomplices take hostage Harrison Ford's family and get him to hack into the computers of his bank. Now, you remember fairly recently there was actually a really, really horrible real news story about something similar happening. It happened just before this movie was press screened. So it's a timely subject. It's Paul Bettany, who we love. It's Richard Longcrane, who directed Richard III, which is great, and of course Slade in Flame. And it sees the return to form of Virginia Madsen, who since Sideways has really her career's had a real resurgence. Unfortunately, although it starts out as a kind of high-tech internet hackery type thriller, it does the thing that all these mainstream American movies do, which is that it ends up with people hitting each other with bits of furniture. There are about 17 different places in which you think, actually, what would happen now is that the hostage takers would just resort to the horrible ultimate sanction, and that would be the end of the story. But it keeps not happening because the story has to keep going. I think Paul Bettany's a great actor. I think he's a great screen presence. He's obviously very good at playing bad guys. If anyone saw him in Gangster No. 1, the British movie, you'd know just how edgy and how dangerous he can be. Virginia Madsen, too, is fine. But in the end, the problem with Firewall is that it ends up being yet another slightly limp Harrison Ford vehicle. Harrison Ford is kind of... it's not that he's too old to do this anymore. It's like he's a bit world-weary. It's like he's as fed up with it as the rest of us. And I was disappointed because I think that Richard Longcrane is a very, very good, stylish director who has, in the past, done great work. This isn't it. And I'm disappointed to have to say that it's a Paul Bettany film that didn't give me a frisson.
Is that the first?
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, even when he was doing the Lars von Trier film, which I rather liked, I mean, I just think he's a very charismatic screen presence. And in this, all the good stuff is him, and all the bad stuff is Harrison Ford romping. And it ends up, as I said, with people just simply punching each other, which you just think, what happens at the script meeting when they go, how are we going to end this? Oh, let's just have them hit each other. All right, then, that'll do fine.
Have you given the ending away?
Well, no, because I haven't told you who hits whom and how.
Well, they hit each other. I mean, I don't think that leaves much to be imagined.
Yeah, but so how does it... what's the outcome?
Well, they hit each other.
Yeah, and...
it hurts. This from Peter says...
It's a film. It doesn't hurt.
I've been podcasting your programme ever since moving to Melbourne. Love the show. I would like to congratulate Mark on his ever-expanding repertoire of impressions. Hilarious and always worth repeat listening. In recent weeks, I've noticed a couple... thankfully, you haven't had any today. In recent weeks, I've noticed a couple of recurring themes.
Mm-hmm.
One, Philip Seymour Hoffman has never been in a bad film. Two, Jennifer Aniston's never been in a good film.
Yep.
Well, that's true. We were doing that a few weeks ago. Well, I present the jury with 2004's romantic comedy Along Came Polly, starring Ben Stiller, best actor in the world, Alec Baldwin, and the aforementioned Philip Seymour Hoffman and Jennifer Aniston. I'm of the opinion that this is a good Jennifer Aniston film, though admittedly all the best laughs come from Hoffman and Baldwin. Yeah. However, I'll leave the final verdict with Mark. Dr. K, what is it to be, a bad Philip Seymour Hoffman film or a good Jennifer Aniston film?
It's a Jennifer Aniston film that is saved by the presence of Philip Seymour Hoffman. It is certainly up there with the top of her career and down there with the bottom of his. And I get the sense that he is dragging her up rather than anything else. It's basically not a great film at all. But on the basis of... had Richard E. Grant been in it as well, it would have gone up another notch. You know, on the Richard E. Grant and Philip Seymour Hoffman together, I mean, it can't be entirely bad, but it's certainly nothing to write home about.
James in Barnstable noticed a new photo of Mark hand on chin on the Five Live website.
Where?
Is this Mark's Brokeback moment? I'll have to check that out. I think it's a very old photograph.
Can I just say that just a few weeks ago, I was out in the field wearing my Carhartt jacket, shearing sheep, and thinking, I'm coming over all broke back, and I wish I knew how to quit you.
There's an image that none of us needed. Shooting Dogs, Basic Instinct 2, and Firewall all done. What else is new?
The Ballad of Jack and Rose, Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, was on the show quite recently. So this is him.
A lot of people thought he was sort of on something. I just think he doesn't do lots of interviews.
Well, funnily enough, he has done a few interviews for this. I mean, obviously, it's kind of been a personal project for him, but he's clearly not, he doesn't enjoy doing interviews. And he seems to lack a sense of humour about it, which I think is more indicative of the fact that he's just uncomfortable. I mean, I saw another interview with him in which he was asked about, the incident with the walking off when he was doing Hamlet and suddenly being confronted by what he thought was a ghost of his past. And this was sort of put forward to him as a ludicrous moment. And he tried his hardest to explain it, but he did end up sounding like a terrible old lovey because it's just simply because clearly that's not his forte. The story here, as you covered in some detail when you were doing the interview, is that he is the father of a girl with whom he has an implied, but it is only implied, incestuous relationship. He has lived on this commune. The commune has fallen apart. He has brought up the daughter on his own. He is now the last of the people in this commune. He is terminally ill, which we know from the beginning, so I'm not giving anything away. The commune is about to be threatened by the arrival of a whole bunch of new developed houses which are about to be built on wetlands, and he decides that the only way to save the situation is to get in somebody else into his house to look after his daughter after he is gone. The somebody else, played by the always impressive Catherine Keener. You know, it's difficult. It's one of those films which you can feel the earnestness, you can feel the amount of investment in it. You think it's probably its heart is in the right place. It looks very, very oodly noodly 70s independent.
What does oodly noodly mean?
It means basically what it doesn't have is an editor standing behind it saying, you know what you need here is you need an exploding helicopter and you need Stan Collymore driving a Porsche through it at 150 miles an hour because otherwise the audience are going to get bored. It's one of those indie films which just ambles and rambles and shambles and ponders and, you know, bumbles and wombles around and then sort of stops and then sort of picks up again and then Beau Bridges comes on and then he goes away and then it all ends up in, you know, kind of inevitable semi-tragic conclusion. Now, this is not to say that it's terrible. It would actually be easy and I have, you know, been slightly flippant about it, but it's just... It's trying very hard. It doesn't have much humour in it, and I think that's always a problem. I tend to have a problem with films that don't have any sense of their own ridiculousness, if there is some ridiculousness to have a sense of. And I think in this case, it could have just taken itself a little less seriously. It feels a little bit like, yes, I'm impressed by the acting. Yes, I'm impressed, but to be honest, I'm getting a little bit bored, and now I'm getting quite bored, and now I'm getting really bored.
Did you fancy Prince Edward Island?
Not in the slightest.
This is where I inserted the word island at the end
yes,
of it.
Yes, sorry.
But it is supposed to be an absolutely stunning place
yes.
to go.
Well, that's fine. And actually, funnily
you're
enough...
still happy in Southampton.
The thing that people say about Jack and Rose is that, somebody said, you know, you can smell the grass, it's fine, it's got a lovely sense of place,
and
a lovely sense
of time.
No, it's just, well, I mean, you can't really, but obviously, unless they're doing it in smell-o-vision, which of course actually was one of the techniques that William Castle did pioneer back in the 1950s, which just didn't work very well, because you couldn't get one smell in after the other, because the smell lingered in the auditorium. So you got the smell of the fart, and then you had to get the smell of the flowers, but you had to get the smell of the farting out first, and it didn't really work, so that's why smell-o-vision
would be great. If someone could work out how to do that properly.
Well, John Waters did then, didn't he? He did Odorama for polyester, which was scratch and sniff. And that worked better because rather than having the auditorium full of the snow, you had a scratch and sniff card. And so when key things would happen, you would scratch and sniff the card. You remember that film?
Yeah, that's just silly, though.
Yeah, it is just silly.
I quite like the way they do that. There's a 3D Shrek thing which they do at Universal Studios whereby when someone spits,
yes.
it actually throws water over you, which is terrific. And I think there are some movies that would... you know, just get a little bit better if they had that kind of facility.
OK, now, very quickly, because we're in the last 5 minutes, two things I want to get out of the way. Firstly, White Countess, which, as you know, it's the end of the Merchant Ivory era, and it is ending, I have to say, not with a bang, but a whimper. You've seen this, right? Typically handsome adaptation, script by Katsuo Ishiguro. Story is 1930s Shanghai. A woman who is a Russian countess now in Shanghai is taken in by a blind Englishman who has dreams of setting up a nightclub, which is, of course, the White Countess. The cast includes not one, not two, but three Red Graves in the form of Vanessa Lynn and Natasha Richardson, at least partially shot by Christopher Doyle. Rafe Fiennes doing his usual solid, fine, understated, if not overly interesting performance. And you sit there thinking, well, it is what it is. It's a bit of heritage movie making. I think actually the national press have been overly cruel about it, but it's just not great. It's the kind of thing that if you saw it on a Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, you'd think, oh, it was quite passable, but it's certainly no more than that. And it's a shame.
You know you're in trouble. There was a point after about an hour, like you said, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's okay. Well, Ralph Fiennes was on doing his... blind former diplomat routine,
yes.
And I was thinking, go on, turn into Lord Voldemort. Just, you know, it would be more fun.
Or turn into the guy out of Wallace and Gromit in The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. You see, I think Ralph Fiennes has got a sense of humour. I just wish we saw more of it. Now, this leads us with Three Burials, a.k.a. The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which I think was the title that it originally had when I saw it in Cannes. Savage modern Western, directed by Tommy Lee Jones and written by Guillermo Arriaga, who was the guy who wrote Amores Perros, which I absolutely love. Set on the board...
Was that the dogfighting?
The dogfighting movie, which, of course, was brilliantly done with no harm to the actual dogs, which just goes to demonstrate as a footnote that it's perfectly possible to make films about dog fighting without harming animals. Those who harm animals take note.
Moving on.
There is no excuse. No, I'm just pointing it out because it's important. It has been compared to some extent to The Proposition, or I think it's a slightly bogus comparison. Tommy Lee Jones directs and stars, and he stars as this ranch hand who... during the course of the movie's very slow, very sort of atmospheric plot development, avenges the death of the title character. And I won't tell you any more about it than that because you're not. The movie reveals its information very slowly. It is a mood piece. It is a very tough, rugged, kind of semi-revenge drama that owes a great deal to the Western genre tradition. And again, you have to understand genre to some extent to get the most out of it. What I thought was most extraordinary about it was that for something which is basically a fairly macho genre, and of course Tommy Lee Jones himself has always been seen as a man's man, it's extraordinary just how strong, just how feisty, just how vibrant the women characters are in the film, underneath the sort of veneer of misery and grime that oversees the community in which this happens. There is in fact this extremely lively undercurrent, and it's almost all in the hands of the women. It's beautifully shot by Chris Menges. It takes its time and it takes a certain degree of patience. It won the Best Screenplay and the Best Actor Award at Cannes, and I have to say, I think on both of those counts, those awards were understandable and, you know, if not necessarily laudable. I think that it really is a fine, grown-up, adult piece of work. It's not for everyone, and it certainly moves much too slowly for audiences who expect everything to be crash-bang-wallop, you know. But if you want crash-bang-wallop, hey, you know, get the film which starts with Stan Collymore driving the car off the bridge. Get Basic Instinct 2. If you want something with a little more substance, then this is the film of the week.
Ian in Bristol, if Kermode says genre once more, I'm going to crash my car.
Sorry.
It is the word of this week.
No, I'm sorry, but...
No, don't say it again.
It's not a matter of not saying it. It's like saying, you know, if a news reporter stopped saying, you know, London. You cannot talk about film without understanding this. And it is the great abnegation of critics nowadays that they don't believe in discussing things as, you know, as genre films. Sorry, there you go.
James says, there I was thinking I was perhaps the only person never to have seen a film involving Philip Seymour Hoffman. Tragically, I have seen Along Came Polly. It is utter bilge with nothing to redeem it, no good jokes and a plot so transparent and lame it makes Shark Tale look complex and clever. I normally agree with Dr. Kermode, but not on this one. Hence, Mr. Hoffman has been in a bad film, but since I didn't even notice him and indeed have difficulty recalling anything about it except a sense of nausea and time carelessly wasted, I can still look forward to his every other performance. So, if we don't want to go and see The Three Burials, what would be our movie of the week?
If you want, honestly, if you want stupid popcorn entertainment that's funny and understands, it has lines in it like, even Oedipus never saw his mother coming, Basic Instinct 2 is the film for you. If you want something with a bit more substance, Shooting Dogs is not just the grim horror story that perhaps it could be portrayed as, but really make the effort to see Three Burials and Melquiades Estrada.
You can enjoy all the delights of this programme again via the website, because it is available as a podcast. Have a fantastic weekend, and we'll see you Monday at 1 o'clock. Drive comes next on AM, on digital and online. This is 5 Live.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.